Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
A Living History production.
I'm Peter Hart.
And I'm Gary Bain.
And together we're Pete and Gary's Military History
Podcast. Hello and welcome to a very special episode of Pete and Gary's Military History Podcast. Today I have a very special guest today. Can you guess who that guest is, children? It's Peter Hart.
Oh, I'm honoured to be your guest, Gary.
Now, the reason for this, Pete, is that you once more have a book being published, and it's this book, Burning Steel, and it's by that fella Peter Hart. I think he writes about skateboarding and stuff, doesn't he, normally? And it's a tank regiment at war, 1939-1945. It's published by Profile, and it's out on the 12th of May. Now, one of the most noticeable things, Pete, is the colour.
It is. What a colour it is. I've never seen that colour before.
It is. It's certainly striking, and it stands out on the bookshelf. It certainly does. So, I suppose I should start with why you wrote the book.
Why I wrote the book? how I wrote the book? Why, yep. I keep on writing the book?
Yeah, and why can't you stop writing?
Gary, that's very hurtful. Why did I write the book? Well, it's because, as you know, my job at the Imperial War Museum was oral history interviewing, and we'd done a projects on various things, and it just struck me that we needed to do something on armoured regiments, and they were the regiment that we chose. We chose them for two reasons. One, they had a very active regimental association. They'd fought in a number of different tanks. And they had a south of the border group, which meant, as I was in England, they were in Scotland, most of them, it was very useful to have a lot of contacts for all the English veterans that had fought for them, because there was at least a third were English.
Now, when we were young, I'm sure you've noticed as well, there were veterans all around us, weren't there?
Oh, everywhere. I mean, my dad wasn't much of a veteran in the sense that he was only in the last month of the war in the Navy, but he was still there. It's more than I've ever done. They were everyone you met, weren't they? So if you looked around, your uncles, nearly all my uncles were in the army. I'm not sure they were any good at it, but they were in the army doing their bits. But whenever you went out, you must have noticed, Gary, when you went out down the streets in the 60s and 70s, that everyone was in.
Yeah, but largely we didn't take much notice of them, did we, Pete? I mean, they certainly didn't seem to talk about their experiences, or did they?
Well, they were every man. They were there. They were all around us. And I suppose a lot of them didn't. And there's the other thing, which we've talked about before, which is Uncle Albert syndrome from that comedy, Only Fools and Horses. Well, about every time he started telling one of his stories, they'd go, leave it, Uncle Albert, that kind of thing.
Oh, they were Welsh.
Yeah, Welsh, yeah. Didn't you know they were? The thing was that they didn't talk in front of their families much because the families weren't interested. They didn't talk. So what they did was that, but they did talk a lot with their friends. So down the pub or when they met, because the friendship groups, and of course the British Legion and the regimental associations. And then they did talk about it, and they talked to me about it because they knew I was just working for the War Museum, and it was the way of making sure that not only their memories, but their memories of the people who didn't make it. That was always incredibly important to them. The men who didn't come back, the men who gave up their whole lives for their country. That was very important to them. And by being interviewed, they could talk about them and they could remember what happened to them.
Yes, because we've got to remember this was a really serious matter, wasn't it? It was a fight against Nazism, real Nazism.
Yeah, I take that very seriously and always have done. That it is an evil regime that had to be stopped. I'm not sure many of the men wanted to or thought of themselves as crusaders, but it was their sort of duty, and they rose to the challenge. I think the point I always make is that they did that, and people like me and you didn't. I know you were in the army, but there's no Nazi regime to fight at the time, although the communist regime was pretty bad.
Now, let's get back to the book for a moment. So what was the role of the Imperial War Museum and the genesis of this project? And whose idea was it, Pete?
Well, the War Museum had started oral history in the 70s under a man called David Lance, and that was their thing. When I arrived in 81, I wanted to sort of do the First World War because they hadn't got enough on it. And I tried to do a regiment because I thought if you get everybody together, interview them all separately, but, the interviews together, then you'd have a full picture of what's going on. I always use the same example. One hand, you can see through the gappies. Two hands, you can't see much. And if you've got 40 or 50 people talking, you get a complete picture with all the outriders, so that the people who don't think what everybody else thinks, who are often wrong, by the way, and you get a sort of consensus in the middle, and it's quite interesting. Sometimes they're right, but we couldn't do that with the Great War, so we started on the Second World War. Those guys were just in the 60s then. They weren't that old. It was because this is in the late 80s, early 90s, and we started with the Durham Light Infantry, fine body of men, I know you want to say, from Durham.
Had you known at that time that all those years later you'd be doing impressions on a podcast, you might have actually picked some areas where you could actually do the accent, Pete.
Well, South, that's as ours. I defend our Derbyshire and Nottinghamshire accents to the limit, because that was the artillery unit we chose. And the tank unit, it was just serendipity that we landed on the 2nd Fife and 4th Fur unit.
We've been corrected, haven't we?
We have been corrected several times. We've been corrected about almost everything. Have you learned how to say bratty fear?
No, so why Fife and Forfar, Pete? I mean, you must have been away from home a lot. You must have missed your loved ones, your lovely Polly. You know, travelling all that way away from the people you loved.
You know damn well that my wife's parents were in Edinburgh when we had our first and second child. She went down there for 3 or 4 months. And although I was commuting back to London, I did live in Scotland quite a long time. And I am, of course, part Scottish.
Yeah.
Although I understand the Scots deny and refute this.
When you did the Durham Light Infantry, you'd probably visited Durham or something.
No, Durham's easy to get to. It's right. 2.5 hours, 3 hours on the train. This was more a thing of so I would go. I was living in Edinburgh for most of the time, and going back and forwards to the various areas in Fife and Forfar.
Now you've alluded to the fact that actually they weren't all from that area at all, were they?
No, they weren't, because they came all over Fife and Forfar. But as the war went on, and in accordance with the principle of the army, which after the Powell's battalions in the First World War, they didn't. They recruited widely across the country and then sent them to various places. So a lot of them were English, and the South of the Border group was set up by a man called Jeff Hayward, who is still alive, amazingly, and is mentioned in the book. In fact, there's a picture of him in the book. He's a lovely man, and he did a lot for the regiment. And so he had a list of about over 100 and we did about 25. About half of the interviews we did were with English people, because it was easier. And I found the melding of the English and the Scottish, it worked very well. They all refer to the banter. They also refer to the odd moment of tension. But the biggest tension was the porridge. You have porridge for breakfast.
Oh, whether it should have salt, I presume.
Or sugar.
Yeah.
I just think you shouldn't have porridge. But
now, you mentioned it briefly, but this project, it followed on from the artillery project on the South Notts Hussars. So that was the 107th Regiment Royal Artillery. And that became your book, At Close Range, An Artillery Regiment at War, 1939-45. So is it the same sort of mythology? Are they very similar books?
Well, they basically they try and tell the story of the regiment using as a main source the oral history, and so yes, they are. Basically, I listen to all the interviews and I get the quotes, and then use them in the war diaries and other sources, and occasional documentary records, and the odd book, the South Notts Society was a couple of good books, and together you blend it together to create the book. You might have noticed I don't play an enormous role in this, and in some ways the book is a collection of veterans' memories, and that's what the book is. And I value that, to be honest. That's what's important to me, is the veterans. Not in a sort of sanctimonious, sentimental manner, but just because that's what it's all about. It's just, I mean, if you're doing a book of veterans' memories, then surely that's what it's about.
And what was it like actually interviewing the veterans in their own homes?
Well, we tried to do that, because if they have to travel, they get tired. And so we always tried to do veterans in their homes, they were so welcoming, they were so nice, and there's the usual courtesies of modern life, you know, they make you a cup of tea or coffee, whatever, and then you look at their garden, and you know me and gardens, I don't even know whether I've got one. I believe Polly looks after ours, but you sit down on the furniture and you have a chat with them, and they weren't that old, when, of course, they were in their late 60s, 70s, most of them, when I saw them. I'm in my late 60s now, so they were perfectly hale and hearty. When I did the First World War veterans, they were in their late 90s, some of them, and that was more testing. But they were lovely. They were so welcoming, so welcoming.
And how would you describe the results? You know, for one thing that strikes me is what scale are we talking about for the collection at the Imperial War Museum?
For the 545, about 50. I'm never good at statistics, you know this. It's a cunning question. And, you know, there's 250, 300 hours. There's hundreds of hours of recordings. I mean, remember that if someone was in the 545 and then went on to do something else, we would follow them through, because, of course, the War Museum doesn't care whether they're 545 or not. So not all of those hours are on the five and four, but a lot of it is. It's the incredible detail. I mean, we've been doing some podcasts on the five and four unit, and the detail in some of the interviews, whether it be about personal relationships or just about what you do in a tank and how you drive it, I remember that we both laughed at the bloke who recently was telling us how you fired the gun, and how there was a button to fire the main gun.
And a button
to fire the machine gun. And if you had big feet, you could cause yourself and the rest of the people around you a bit of a surprise if you pressed the wrong one. And I just think that's what oral history is good for. Where did they sleep at night? The latrines, all this stuff. And then, of course, there's the odd awful story that comes out, like the latrine. The bloke goes off for a crap, doesn't he? And he goes in a wheat field, out of the way, and finds a gap in it. In the middle is a German with his jugular cut, and he's been running round and created almost a crop circle, trying to bind it up with a newspaper, and he just died. And by then he was rotting.
And he makes reference to the pink colour, which is obviously from his blood staining.
Yeah, and so you get mixed up with the sort of mundane details. You get these horrendous stories, and And some of the stories about, you know, with tanks, it can be quite grim.
We'll come on to that. But just in case some people haven't perhaps caught up with the story on the podcast, can you just outline the story of the 2nd Fife and 4th Fire Yeomanry and why you didn't pick a tank regiment that's easier to pronounce?
Yeah, the 3rd Tank Regiment would have been ideal. They're formed in Fife and Forfa around the towns. There'd be a squadron in each town. The regiment had doubled and tripled in size in the immediate lead up to the war. They were training all round Scotland and England and Ireland. They actually go to Ireland. They get a variety of tanks. They start off in the Mark VI, which is sort of a reconnaissance tank, and looks like something from the First War. It looks quite like the French Renault, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. And it was much smaller than I imagined as well.
Yeah, especially in that model someone sent us a picture of.
Yes.
That was definitely small. I'm not sure you'd have got in that, Gary. And then they're training there, and they eventually get the Shermans. And it's an incredibly long time because various changes in British armoured divisions. They don't go to war until after D-Day, and they go across in mid-June, and they're involved in a series of battles. The Battle of Epsom, which culminates in being on Hill 112, which we've both been to. And then that's followed up a month later with Operation Goodwood, which is a horrendous massacre.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to BOLLandBranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Each time they're rebuilt, it's amazing. The British Army, they're just more tanks, new tanks, new crews arrive. And then they move on from there to being in Operation Bluecoat, which is a fairly successful operation on the left flank of the big American advance. And then from then on, it becomes just another day at the office. They're involved in a huge, rapid advance through France. They get to Antwerp, and then later on they're at the Ardennes battle, peripherally, but they're there as some of the reinforcements sent to help the Americans. And the final denouement is the advance through Germany and culminating in the success. Like all regimental histories, it ends with sort of an anticlimax in the very sense that, of course, the men just go home. So I've tried to say a bit about what happened to the men when they got home, picked on some of the characters just to say how they got back into civilian life and how it affected them, how they were affected by their experiences. I'm very proud of it, but as I say, the pride basically is that I'm involved in it, lucky enough to be involved in it. It's not all about me.
No.
But one of the things I found surprising about the book is they sort of have a phony war period. You made reference to them going to Ireland, for example, to defend the English coast. So they had this...
Not sure geography was high command strong point.
So they have this period. And what surprised me is that that's as interesting as the action in the book, as it were, because you get to know the characters. And there are some real characters in this book, aren't there?
There are, and yes, and that I think it's important to get to know them before you see them in battle. You could see them in their sort of normal lives. And, I mean, being in the army is not particularly normal, but they get a chance to meet them, and we get to know people. I'll perhaps come back to some of them later, but we get to know them. Steele, Brownie, Charlie Workman, people like this, some of the officers, Jeff Hayward I mentioned earlier, and we get to meet all these people before the fighting, the shooting starts. Because if you don't know them before they react to that, then you don't really know them. And I think it's important to get both sides. Also, just to get through how important, going to the military thing, how important training is. You're not a trained soldier unless you're a trained soldier. You have to be trained so that you react by instinct and you can put up with things that normal civilians can't dream of putting up with because it's just too hard or too dangerous. And yes, you need training.
And I'd just like to mention one of my personal favourites is a man called Gordon Fidler, who's an interesting character, Peter, isn't he?
He is. I like Gordon Fidler. You like it because of the name, most of all. He's, one of his relatives is in touch with us and has been about the book. And I just like that. Gordon Fidler, we follow him right the way through. And it's great. You'll follow him. If you don't want to buy the book, you'll hear about him in the podcast as well, because he's cropping up regularly, isn't he?
Although by the book, of course, and you get a bit more detail.
So I'm so popular with my publisher. Oh, yes.
You mentioned William Steele Brownlee. Is that where the title of the book comes from, or is there another reference to Burning Steele?
There's references to Burning Steele. This is the battle scenes. And there's an interview that says, a man who says, you can't believe that a tanker, that steel will burn, that a tank will burn. But they do. They just go up like Ronsons, like first time. There's a variety of reasons. The petrol, of course, or diesel, whatever it is. Remember, what an expert I am. But the main cause is the ammunition is the German shells can penetrate the turret, and once they get in there, there's ammunition around there, and they just go woof. I mean, sometimes they don't. You've got a minute or two to get out, but sometimes they just go woof. And some of the interviews are painful to listen to. They're painful to read about as well. People are caught in the tank, and you know they lose. There's one Chris Nichols who loses his legs and falls back in the tank and is burnt to death. Charlie Workman, one of the officers, saw that happening. It left a lifetime of scarring. He also was a bloke who, one of his tank crew was burnt and is lying on the floor looking like basically a sack of I don't know what, and just saying, shoot me, sir. I mean, he didn't. He just died. There's some very upsetting material in it. The burnt corpses and just the sheer horror of it, people losing their nerve, people keeping their nerve, it's all there. And yet, despite all this, there's still something that you and I would appreciate. What is the one thing you might not be expecting in all that horror?
Well, I assume you're making reference to how they cope with it, with some humour sometimes, which is very dark.
Yeah, and that is quite important, and that comes out at times in the book as well. And one of my favourites, a lighter story, is they're having to evacuate the tank and in a hurry, and they know the officer's got a bottle of whiskey in there, and one of them tries to get it, leaps back into the tank, which is to get the whiskey. That sort of thing cheers you up a bit amidst some of the misery.
Now they're largely featuring the Sherman tank, which they must have been really pleased to get because that's practically impregnable, wasn't it?
And that's what they thought when they got it. But it of course, it wasn't. It was easily penetrable. The gun was 75 millimetre, excellent for firing high explosive, didn't really have enough muzzle velocity to fire armour piercing.
Although there were variants, weren't there?
There were variants. The Firefly, you're thinking of. has got a 17-pounder, but they only had one per troop, if that, and that was called forward. Most of the Shermans couldn't really deal with the Panther or the Tiger, and things are confused by the fact that every Mark IV was a Tiger to most of the lads. Yeah. But do you blame them for not identifying a tank in all the battle smoke and just...
Well, they'll get a glimpse of it, won't they?
Yeah. That's it. And of course, it's a Tiger. It's just what they call them. And the Sherman wasn't really up to the job, but there were a lot of them. And this is the thing in war. What are we going to do? Not wait for a better tank or a better tank does arrive. They're in the Comets from December, from January 1945. The last 5 months of the war, they're in Comets, which is a much better British tank. That's not a criticism of the American nature of the Sherman. The Sherman had many qualities. There are lots of them. The gun was okay. They could deal with a Mark IV German. It just took three or four of them to deal with a Panther. And you call for the RAF and the Typhoons if you get Tigers. The Sherman, it's a controversial tank. It's very high as well, so it's very difficult to hide it. But the main thing is it just caught fire. That's the thing that people came to associate it with. But as a weapon of war, it did its job in the sense of the 11th Armored Division, which had a lot of them, was a powerful unit, and it had a big impact on the war. So it's one of those terrible things. That's what you've got. That's what you'll have to have, lads.
And in such numbers that, unlike the Germans, the losses could be pretty quickly replaced, I assume.
Yeah, they replaced them normally at the end of the same day. Amazing. They rescued a lot of the ones and knocked out and repaired them. Just very efficient.
Yep. Now, having interviewed all these people, I get the impression that you're actually slightly melancholy in as much that, you know, as you mentioned, Jeff Hayward's still alive, but very few are still alive.
I think Harold Wilson, which is a name that caused us to smile when we saw it, but he's still alive. I think you've got to be careful about this because they're 90-odd. But all my other favourites are dead. I remember Pinky Hutchison. He's a rather posh...
Why is he called Pinky?
Because of his complexion. He was quite chubby, a bit like other people I know. Both of us, to be honest. Pinky Hutchison, he was such a character. He was a sort of minor landed gentry. Not so minor, in my view. He was wonderful. The interview's fabulous. I really liked a chap called Ray Valance, who's died. He was your archetypal NCO. He was English. Archetypal NCO, but got better and better. He used to row with William Steele Brownlee because they were in the same troop for a while, and then they gradually got to be friends and or at very least appreciate each other. And he was a great chap. And Ray Valance stayed in the army. He'd become so good. He ended up a major and he fought in the Korean War. What a guy! He lived in Norfolk. William Steele Brownlee, I did an interview, and that's a great regret. He died, but he left a wonderful memoir, which is in the War Museum and in other places. And always known as Steele Brownlee, never used William. And he's just the archetypal thrusting young officer. Brilliant at tactics, didn't like the English much. He's one of the ones who didn't like the English much. And just such a character. And and that's why the Burning Steele was a good pun, if you like, because he just plays such a huge part in the book. His memoir is brilliant. I urge people to read it. It should be republished, really. Well, published. It's not been published.
And the term Burning Steele, that gives rise to how they describe the Shermans going up. They call it brewing up, don't they?
Brewing up. Terrible. Yeah, brewing up. Ronson's always likes first time. It's terrible, terrible.
So would you describe these veterans, given that you've interviewed both Great War and Second World War veterans, would you describe them as our greatest generation?
Interesting. I don't know. Both generations are fabulous, in my view, and both of them did their duty. And people say, well, the Second World War generation were fighting the Nazis. They're an evil regime. But I'll be honest with you, the Kaiser's regime wasn't particularly friendly either and did some terrible things. So, I can't judge between them. But it's an interesting question that people will always debate, who think you have to have someone better than the other. I think they're just say they're great and leave it at that, if you see what I mean.
I think
that both generations did so much for us, that's the truth of it.
So what's the next project, Pete? You've done At Close Range, the artillery regiment at war. You've done Burning Steel, a tank regiment at war. I think I might know where this is going.
Infantry, yeah. And the title of the book, I'm doing it now, is Foot Sloggers, an infantry regiment at war, 1939-45. And that's about the 16th, Gary, Durham Light Infantry. We've talked about the importance of the artillery. We talk about the importance of the tanks, but the infantry are at the base of everything, or at the bottom of everything, as they would describe it. But they have, I mean, whatever the others do, you have to occupy the ground. You have to finish the job. And that's what I'm working on now. I know you'll be looking forward to that, Gary.
I will be. Just before we finish, Pete, I know that you like to pay tribute to the Imperial War Museum and the work that they do. Is any of the recordings available to the public?
They don't seem to be up at the moment. I am in touch with my former boss, Tony, to see if they can be put up, because the copyright's fine once they're dead. There's always a trouble with oral histories. People are talking about each other and they're not always saying nice things. And so the War Museum feels that they shouldn't go on until pretty well everyone's dead, and pretty well everyone is dead now. So I'm hoping they'll go up very soon, yeah.
And is there any charge involved with that, or do you think they'll be made available free?
Oh, no, well, you can go and listen to them now, I think, in the museum. But they'll be on the internet, on the War Museum's website, which would be IWM.com or something. I don't know what it is. I can never remember. But they're on there, and you just type it in. It's an amazing collection. There are something 35, 40,000 interviews at the War Museum. The 5 and 4 5 are just a small part of it. But, the War Museum, although I initiated the project, the War Museum paid for everything. They paid my salary, they paid the expenses, and they deserve enormous credit for their foresight in starting the oral history project.
Do you think that might have been because, as you mentioned, when you started the Great War Project, it was perhaps a little late because there weren't that many of them left, so they've tried to be earlier, as it were, with subsequent conflict?
It's partly because we were there and we were the ones who sort of tried to finish off. They'd started early with the First World War project, but they'd only done a couple of hundred. And you need thousands. And I think there's 1,700 First World War veterans now, because myself, other members of staff and the freelancers did it. But we'd already started, even when I'd arrived, we were already doing interviews with Second World War veterans. But this idea of doing lots of people from the same unit to get a real picture inside a unit, which stands for all the other units that are similar. I think it's important work. I'm proud of the book. I'm proud of what it represents and the lads that we interviewed.
And so you should be. As you mentioned, we are perhaps best known nowadays for our podcast. And there is a current series, which is dealing with the 5 and 4 5 Yeomanry. So people can listen to the story and they can hear the tales of people like Ray Valance and Gordon Fidler, which I find incredibly moving, but also incredibly interesting. And I guess that at some point in the future, we'll be doing some podcasts on foot sloggers, because we appear to do the podcasts around about the time the book comes out.
It's some sort of weird coincidence. I've no idea how it happens. So I'm Matt McLaughlin, not to be called.
I'm just going to make reference once more, Pete, to Burning Steel. It is available from the 12th of May, presumably from all good and some bad outlets.
Yeah, varying prices, knowing our world, yeah.
Well, thanks very much for your time, Pete. It's been a real pleasure today. I am thoroughly enjoying the colour of the book. I'm having hours of fun.
Looking at it. It's got pictures and as well.
Yeah, unfortunately, no crayons.
No crayons, right. You can't colour them in. Oh, poor Gary.
Thanks for your time, Pete. Cheers.
Cheers, thank you.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Thanks for listening. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook to learn more about each episode. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you have a couple of options. You can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/PGMH or consider subscribing to the podcast for only £2 per month and get ad-free listening and bonus content. You can find links for both on our Facebook and Twitter accounts.
Sounds great, doesn't it?